Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. ESPN's documentary series Basketball, A Love Story is not only a historical tribute to a much-loved sport, it's also a riveting portrait of some of the political and cultural issues that have shaped our world. Race, gender, workers' rights, Cold War politics, capitalism, globalization, all being played out on a 94 by 50-foot court. And although the series takes 20 hours and 62 short stories, that may not be nearly enough. It's airing on ESPN Tuesday nights from 8 until midnight, and joining me now to discuss it are its creator, Peabody Award-winning director, or is its creator, Peabody Award-winning director Dan Cloris. And welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
In one of the segments, many basketball greats talk about how they fell in love with the game. What's your story?
It's I grew up in Brooklyn in the 50s and 60s. We comfort ourselves saying we were lower middle class, but we were poor. My father sold pots and pans door to door, and the parents slept on the Castro convertible couch. My brother and I shared a bed, and getting out of the house, that apartment where there was just arguing going on and strife was critical. So that's how I found my release, was playing basketball, finding friends, and going from park to park and neighborhood to neighborhood. And so I fell in love with it and became addicted to it. And that's one of my unwritten theses in the film, is that unlike all other sports, basketball has an addictive, obsessive component, i.e. love. That's why these short stories are both sides of love.
And one of the reasons that it has been so popular in poor neighborhoods is because it doesn't require a lot of equipment.
Correct. And from the beginning, the immigration and the movement to this country by early groups in urban areas in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the Irish and the Jewish immigrant, and they landed in the big cities on the Northeast. The Middle Europeans came here to the seaports, but moved to the west. They moved west: Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, western Pennsylvania. The same situation, struggling people. All you needed was a ball or some type of place to put it in.
And it's interesting to look over the history of basketball and see the different groups that dominated at different times.
Yes, dominated.
Or played major roles. I mean, there were no Russians or Lithuanians in the early days.
No, Germans and Dutch, and didn't call people of color African Americans. There were blacks. There were Jews. There were Irish, as I said, there were French, and there were all of these. That was early AAU. Those were semi-pro teams that would play on the weekends, barnstorm around America, women's teams too, and play for money. And they would bet on their games. The coaches and players would bet against each other on the games.
The first basketball player to score in the NBA was a Jewish player.
Right, I think.
Whose name has been forgotten, but one of the first big stars was Dolph Schayes.
And Dolph Schayes was my second interview. I met his son, Danny, who played in the NBA for many years at an NBA All-Star game, and I wanted to get to the older fellas first. My first interview was with Jack Ramsey. There were 165 interviews.
Wow.
I interviewed Russell for 5.5 hours, Oscar for 6. These were not 10-minute interviews. Dolph Schayes in his home in Syracuse, a lovely man, a very, very bright man, went to NYU at 16, and obviously had a Hall of Fame career after that.
Now, this series lasts 20 hours. Were you pitching it as a 20-hour project at first?
No. I wanted to do it years ago as a 10-hour, five-part film.
It was a different game in those days.
Not that long ago, 10 years ago. I went to Dick Ebersole, a very sophisticated, talented, probably the best television sports executive ever, and he was very smart. Much smarter than me, when he walked me out of the office, Leonard, he had his hand around my shoulder, and I thought I had it. No, it was a rejection. He was pretty savvy. And then ESPN said, they'll do it, but about a couple of months later, they said we didn't have enough money. So about 5 years ago, I had a crisis in my life, and frankly, I needed a distraction, a major distraction. When I think it through, it was so natural for it to be this film, to be basketball, because that was my distraction when I was a child. That's what I gave everything to. So that's why I rethought it and did it.
Had you already made your Peabody Award-winning film, Black Magic?
Yes. When ESPN said they didn't have the money the first time, John Skipper, the head of ESPN at the time, said, we want to do something with you. So I came up with the idea of Black Magic, which was very, very fortunate for myself. I learned so much, and I met so many wonderful people. I reconnected with Ben Job, the great coach and teacher who I knew at South Carolina in the early 70s, and I reconnected with Ben, and we were friends since then, best friends. He passed last year. I've dedicated the film to Ben Job and to my father, this film.
And so I'm sure winning a Peabody didn't hurt when you were pitching this idea. But why did you decide to break it into so many segments?
Well, once it went from 10 hours to 12 hours.
Originally, you thought it would be a history of basketball?
No, I never wanted to do a history. Never. I have all the respect in the world for Ken Burns, of course. But I did not want to do what he did in baseball, which was a history. I wanted to do short stories all along. Mm-hmm. I was thinking they were vignettes, and then someone said, they're short stories. This is opening up a book of short stories.
But then you had to decide which ones to put together with which, because they're on different nights.
Yes, but I work from a yellow legal pad in longhand, and what I wrote out for those short stories 5 years ago, is really, really similar to what it turned out to be. I added some, lost some, and then I was able to use what I learned in the interviews and come up with ideas that have nothing to do with teams winning or losing. Nothing to do with that. They have to do with the mind. When a coach wins, do you find joy or relief? Is when you're so great as a Michael Jordan or LeBron, or are you born with, or a Russell, are you born with a genius gene? Or is it something that's developed? Superstitions, signature moves. There are four different scenes where individuals talk about their hands, hips, eyes, feet, mind in their signature move. Earl Monroe the spin, Iverson on the crossover, LeBron going rim to rim, Chris Paul making the steal. That's what I learned when I was going along, and that was a great deal of joy in making this.
One of the amazing aspects of this series, for someone who isn't as an obsessive fan of the game, is how many important issues in U.S. history and culture are reflected in these short stories.
Yeah,
Was that part of your plan?
Yes, of course. I mean,
you're talking politics here. You're
I'm ABD. It sounds like a disease now in American history. I was going for my doctorate, which was going to, many years ago, on the absolute conscientious objector in American World War II, which I actually almost finished writing. So this is very important to me. And I went into this thinking that basketball mirrors, I don't want to overstate it, race relations in this country. I don't want to overstate it. But, and it does. I also went into it, Leonard, knowing that I was not going to segregate women. I wasn't going to do, here's my 7-minute scene on women. No way. They were going to be integrated throughout the entire piece. But the first time we put a camera, I did 122 of the 165 interviews myself. The first time we put a woman on camera, Val Ackerman, I didn't do the interview. And I read the transcript and I started crying because that she was the voice of the outsider. Women in basketball, the voice of the outsider, the same thing as people of color, the same thing as the Jewish and the Irish immigrant. And you close your eyes, they had nothing. So then 18 or 19 different women in the piece, and that was my big lesson here. Just like I had a big lesson in Black Magic, just like I had a big lesson in Viva Baseball or in Crazy Love, that was my big lesson right here.
I'm speaking with Dan Cloris, who has put together a 20-hour series of short story films under the heading Basketball, A Love Story, being broadcast on Tuesdays between 8 o'clock and midnight. So that's 4 hours over, what, five
different Tuesdays, not Election Day. You know, the other thing politically, big thing. I mean, obviously race relations. But basketball even though Naismith was Canadian, but he was working in America. Remember Gilbert Seldes' book?
The guy who's credited with inventing
it. Right. Seldes' book, The Seven Lively Arts, talks about seven original forms of American popular culture, comic strips, jazz, blah, blah, blah. So basketball is one of those things. It's not in Seldes' book, but that's one of those things. So basketball has been a particularly dominant American invention. And I'm trying to show that we began teaching it as early as the late 40s, John McClendon and Red Auerbach in Europe, and we felt great pride about it, but boom, the Cold War. Mm. And that's important.
In fact, let's talk about one of the segments airing tomorrow night, the one called Glasnost.
Yes.
Why did the State Department decide to send an American team to play basketball against the Soviet Union, which was then the U.S.'s enemy in the Cold War?
Well, we were American. We were going to teach others how to play, just like we were going to teach others how to industrialize. You know, so basketball had always been taught there. And the history with the Russians stems from the Olympics. And, of course, we would win and win and win until that game in 1972 Olympics, which is featured in the film, the 72 Olympics in Munich. And, quite frankly, the American team got robbed of the gold medal, first time we ever lost, creating great strife. Now, later, in the late 80s, during a lot of friction between America and Russia in the 88 Olympics, the Lithuanian team, the Russian team, comprised of all of the different nation states in Russia or states in Russia.
Well, the Soviet Union.
Soviet Union upset America, a gigantic upset, and that put American thinkers into disarray. It was humiliating.
Do you think that the reason basketball has become so popular around the world is because of what we said earlier, that it requires so little
same exact
equipment?
Thing. Same
so
thing.
There are Italian leagues and there are Greek leagues. And
all over the world, all over Asia, all over Africa. It's an easy game to play. All you need is a ball and a basket. And there's a relief. You could pretend. You could fantasize. You could feel safe. So that's all around the world. David Falk, the agent, says in the film, and I think it's true, his statement, there are more people playing basketball in China every day, 300 million every day, than there are in the United States. And I think I have no reason to think that's not accurate. I mean,
and they've even given the NBA one of its tall men.
You know, Yao Ming, I interviewed Yao Ming. I loved it. Very bright. English is pretty good. And I asked him, and it's in the film, because he carried the Chinese flag in the Beijing Olympics, I think, in 2012. I asked him in the film, I said, did you ever think what would happen to you if you dropped that flag? And he looked at me and says, oh, that would be a very, very bad thing. Very bad.
I was very surprised to learn from your documentary that Jerry Garcia, of Grateful Dead fame, sponsored the Lithuanian team after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Well, it was the Dead, not only
Garcia.
It was Garcia,
the group, the team, the you know, whole
and,
group.
And I loved it because I must have seen the Dead, I don't know, 60, 70 times in my life. I hadn't seen him since 1974 in Roosevelt Stadium, I think the night that Nixon resigned. But that's a different stage. The Lithuanians in 1992 had no money. Russia was opened up. Lithuania was its own place. There was no money. They were the defending Olympic champion. So Don Nelson's son, Donnie, an assistant coach at Dallas, knew these Russian players, Marshallonis and Sabonis, the Lithuanian players, and introduced them to this band. And Marshallonis, this great Hall of Fame Russian player, Lithuanian player, says in the film, he says, yes, when I met with them, there were some strange odors. but the uniforms that they bought them were tie-dye Dead T-shirts. And they finished second to the Dream Team, which was partially, the Dream Team was created as partially a result of the 1988 United States defeat.
Because the United States saw basketball as a way to be superior in
absolutely
at least one sport.
Dominant.
And then suddenly we were no longer superior.
Absolutely.
We were not dominant anymore.
That's right. And the same thing happened in 2004 when the United States lost to the Argentines in the silver medal game and they won the gold medal. I mean, we put together a terrible team. It's all in the film. I mean, Marbury and Allen Iverson with the backcourt. They're never going to pass the ball to anyone. So now what are we going to do? And now David Stern hires Jerry Colangelo, who is very, very astute, very smart, a great leader. And he hires Mike Krzyzewski, a college coach. And since then, we've been dominant again. But the world obviously has caught up. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful?
But I'm thinking about the politics again, what happened in Yugoslavia, which wasn't even a part of the Soviet bloc, but they refused to play the Star Spangled Banner. Why?
Yes,
that was Tito's Yugoslavia.
Tito's Yugoslavia, and that's when that was in the mid '60s, and the American players, which was an all-star team of Kuzi and Pettit, I mean, they forced them to play the national anthem. But in those days, even in late '50s, it's in the film. Basketball is great. I mean, you had NBA cities, Rochester and Fort Wayne, and Tommy Heinsohn and Kuzi and guys like that describe it. The fans were wild. They weren't throwing beer cans at the players. They were throwing batteries at the players. Red Auerbach liked to get dressed up. In one game against the St. Louis Hawks, before the playoff game, he punched out the St. Louis Hawks owner, Ben Kerner, punched him out right in the court, and they were throwing eggs at Red Auerbach the entire game, hitting him in the head, hitting him in his suit. And no one gets thrown out in those days.
Yeah, well, it is inappropriate to punch somebody under any circumstances.
Right, but they didn't get thrown out.
Kuzi made a famous foul shot in that game against Yugoslavia.
Kuzi made a famous foul shot in that game, but Kuzi,
he was one of the greatest players I've ever
absolutely
seen.
Absolutely. Just a gem from New York, of course. He and George Mikan were the first pro superstars because the NBA was boring. But Kuzi and Mike, and then the invention of the 24-second clock, and then the advent of the first four black superstars, Russell, Chamberlain, Baylor, and Oscar, that led the league into a new age of television. But Kuzi is hilarious. He's about 90 years old now, and he was the first great ball handler, of course. Kuzi missed a big foul shot in the 57 finals with 3 seconds to go. Boston ends up winning the championship in double overtime against the St. Louis Hawks with Bob Bennett and Cliff Hagan. It's all in the film. And Kuzi missed a foul shot. He made 32 of 32 free throws before that in the series, misses the foul shot to win. And he says in the film, for years he would receive letters from fans. Dear Mr. Kuzi, I'm so happy you won the 57 championship, the first championship for the Celtics, but can you tell me why Arnold, meaning Red Auerbach, made you miss that foul shot on purpose?
They assume that? They conspiracy assume that. Theories even in
even
basketball.
Even then, conspiracy theories.
Well, but foul shots are interesting because you would think that they would be the easiest thing to make. You don't have a defender on you. You do talk about the rituals some players have.
Yes.
But why do they? Why do some players who can score from all over the court fail when they have the easiest shot? Is it about nerves or pressure?
Different thing. Nerves is a factor in free throw shooting. Obviously, form, follow through. We have a scene coming up on Tuesday night on two of the great foul shooters of all time, Rick Barry and Calvin Murphy, who are on the same team.
Now, Rick Barry took his shot underhanded, which was a shocker at the time. You'd think more would do that.
There is one person that does it now. You would think so. And he did it in spite of the criticism. Oh, that's the way a girl would shoot. Meanwhile, he shot 94% from the free throw line. And Bill Walton says it when all the old guys get together and they say, well, who's the guy you'd rather have take a free throw or make a last second basket? Rick Barry is always the answer to the free throw. I mean, he was a great, great player, an odd duck, but top 15 of all time, easy.
Also part of a dynasty.
Rick Barry?
Yeah.
Well, Golden State in 75, and he won the championship. But people in the film admit it. I mean, Wes Unseld says, to this day, I hate Rick Barry. Rick Barry was a hated figure, but he was a brilliant, highly competitive.
That's got to be a factor on teams, because these are small groups. If one guy is an annoying person and one woman is an annoying person, that can really have a bad effect on a team.
Well, of course, I try to pay attention in Basketball Love Story to championship teams who don't get their due. Dallas in the pros, Detroit Pistons when Larry Brown coached in the pros, Kansas in college, Arkansas in college, Florida wins two in a row in college, because Seattle and Washington pros. No one talks about those teams. Championship teams have one similarity. It gets right to what you were saying. It's not merely the chemistry. It's the fact that they buy into their roles, and that's chemistry. You walk into a championship locker room in any sport, and it's different than a locker room that even wins a ton of games. There's a maturity. Just like there's a maturity around this table here. When you work with people that you trust, all of you together, you're on a hum.
Yeah, but there's a big difference if you're on a football team where you have a lot of players. You can avoid some of the jerks, even in baseball where there are at least 25.
Well,
in basketball,
there's still 12 or 15. You don't have to be friends off the court. You just have to acknowledge, if I have a shot but there's a better shooter than me, then I'm giving him the ball.
Now, you mentioned that Calvin Murphy was the other great free throw shooter.
Yeah.
What technique did he have to become
so accurate? He had a regular technique, except repetition is the key. And he said, I stood 15 feet away on the foul line, not 15 feet, 1 inch. My elbows tucked in, my follow through is there. And his concentration level was intense. So he made 75 or 76 free throws in a row, set the record. When he finally missed, the referee gave him the ball. And he says in the film, I don't want that ball. It's the ball I missed with. But Calvin Murphy was 5'8", averaged 38 points a game in college, in the Hall of Fame, 5'8", single, maybe one of the two single toughest fist fighters in history in the NBA. And he went to the University of Niagara. He's from Connecticut, 1966. Here's how he was recruited. It's in the, you know what he says? He was also the nation's baton twirling champion.
Oh, my.
So Niagara said, you come here and we'll get you a gig at halftimes. You could twirl a baton at Buffalo Bills NFL games. That was it. He went.
Now, he was 5'8".
Yeah.
This is a sport that is dominated by tall guys, and one of your segments that's airing tomorrow is called Little Big Man, about the smaller players. 5'8 is pretty much as short as it gets. Tiny, how tall was Tiny Archibald?
5'11 at best.
Yeah, so most of the small men are over 6 feet tall, but they're still considered small men.
This scene tomorrow night is on, it's called Little Big Men, as you say. It's on Calvin Murphy, Isaiah Thomas, Chris Paul, Lenny Wilkins, Steve Nash. Isaiah, there's a few others, Calvin. What they have in common is a desire to win at all costs, an athleticism that they know how to control and take advantage of.
But they also can usually control the play, the rhythm of the play. Do smaller players require a better knowledge of the nuances of the
yes,
game?
Yes, good question. Smaller players do, because the ball's in their hand. It's their job to make everyone else better. And as that position has evolved, it's still that's one fact of the game. Everyone needs to trust and like the point guard. And I went into it asking everyone I interviewed, didn't know where I wanted to go yet, about the paint. What does the paint mean to you? And as they would describe the paint, which is the foul area at the foul shooting area between the foul line and the basket, they would say, they would tell me what it meant to them. And then I came up with the idea of little big men. Rather than do a scene on the paint, little big men.
Well, we will talk about the big guys in just a moment. But I want to remind our listeners that they're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. We are back with Dan Cloris, who is the creator and director of a 20-hour group of short stories that is being broadcast on Tuesday nights on ESPN under the heading Basketball, A Love Story. In one episode, Elvin Hayes talks about how he didn't want to attend an all-white university. Where was he from?
Yeah, Elvin Hayes was from rural Louisiana, grew up in only with black people, was taught to distrust whites at all times. This was about 1966. He was a phenomenal athlete, 6'8", averaged about 45 points a game in high school. There was a coach at the University of Houston named Guy Lewis from the Southwest that recruited him and one other African-American player named George Reynolds, and he convinced Elvin Hayes to come to Houston. The only other options for black athletes from the rural South at that time were historical black colleges, and once in a while, like in the case of Connie Hawkins, go to Iowa or Dayton or one of the Catholic schools in the Midwest. So Hayes goes to Houston.
Well, Connie Hawkins could have gone to a New York school, couldn't he?
He could have gone to St. John's, yeah. Yes. But I think they were, let's face facts. I mean, you know, the argument now about kids being paid, it's always been that way. And, you know, there were solicitations made to the great players. Come here and we'll help take care of you. And when you're really poor, well, why the hell not?
And that's why earlier when some of the great players were playing for New York's free colleges, CUNY colleges, there was a point-shaving scandal.
In the film, I deal with the two point-shaving scandals, one in the 1950 and two nights later, the shaving scandal in 1960. Both were tragic stories. Both were spearheaded by the New York City District Attorney Frank Hogan, who took over for Tom Dewey. And in the 50s, it was terrible. You had at one point NYU would play Seton Hall, and all 10 players were dumping points. I mean, it was real. The gambling that went on around the game in Madison Square Garden, the point shaving scale in the 1950s, which sent many, many kids to jail and banned lots of those players from ever playing professionally in the NBA or the league. It banned them. They were permanently banned from ever playing.
Even if some of them were not accused of having engaged in the point
shaving. Well, the 50s, it was a little clearer that there were more guilty people than there were in the 60s. I mean, the 50s, they were dumping games. And it was a mob-run thing. A gangster named Salvatore Salazzo, who offered his wife, a beautiful woman, up even to some of these kids. And CCNY, who won the NCAA and the NIT championship that year, they were the only school ever. Believe it or not, CCNY won both. The NIT was bigger than the NCAA. And almost everyone on that team was shaving points, as they had at NYU, as they had at St. John's, as they had at LIU. It destroyed the college game in New York City, and it gave birth to this new merger of professional leagues called the NBA.
Getting back to Elvin Hayes, where did he wind up playing?
So he goes to University of Houston, and in the film, He's very uncomfortable the first couple of months there, and he's not talking to anyone, and he's in a classroom. This is in the film, and there's a white girl, and he has teachers telling him, "Hey, you could be in my class, but I'm never going to pass." And they use the N-word. Mm-hmm. That's what they tell this child. They say it to him. So now he's in a class, and he says, "You know, every day I'm in this class, there's this white girl looking at me and staring at me and looking really uncomfortable." So, and shaking. So I say to her one day, "What you got?" And she says, "I got you." "I got you." This is the atmosphere many people then. I went to school down south in 1967. I'm at the University of South Carolina. It's the only school I can get into. I was a real screw up. I mean, real screw up. And you wouldn't believe it. I mean, there were 8,000 students there, only 30 blacks, and they're arguing about the Civil War day and night.
Things have only changed a bit since that time.
I think things have changed more than a bit.
Just look at what's going on in the news.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, but things have changed a lot.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was then known as Lew Alcindor, refused to consider offers from Southern colleges or universities. Do you think that that was pretty much the feeling of a lot of black players at the time, or was it because he was a New Yorker?
Well, there weren't that many offers. I mean, for Alcindor, he could have gone to places. There weren't that many. They called them majority institutions. The only ones that would even consider taking a black player then were Wake Forest, Maryland, and Duke. So he didn't want to go down there. He says in the film, "I didn't want to be a trailblazer," or University of North Carolina. Charlie Scott, another New Yorker, broke the barrier at North Carolina. But this is funny. Charlie Scott says in the film, and he was valedictorian at Stuyvesant High School, right? And he says in the film, he was going to go to North Carolina, but the coaches at Villanova, an African-American coach named George Raveling, wanted him so bad, in order to get him away from North Carolina, would send him newspaper articles about lynchings in the South.
Ooh.
So, you know,
later we have Dean Smith.
Dean Smith was the coach there.
Yeah, but later he has pretty much all black teams.
Well, of course, everyone. The University of Alabama by 1972 is starting four blacks. Charlie Scott also says, and I remember this vividly, when you're in the stands or on the bench in a Southern university in those days, 67, 68, 69, the band is playing Dixie, and the fans are standing up and cheering. Now, here I am at the Fieldhouse, the University of South Carolina, 1967, a Jewish guy from New York, and they're playing Dixie, and everyone's getting up, and I'm saying, I don't know about this. I don't think I'm going to stand up. You know? But that's what Charlie Scott had to face. So Dean Smith, unbelievably bright and sensitive, would not bring his team out until after Dixie played.
That was before kneeling.
That was way before kneeling.
But, Lew Alcindor wound up going to California.
He goes to UCLA. Ralph Bunch writes a letter of recommendation, wrote him to get him to come to UCLA. Jackie Robinson did. I mean, there was an all-out effort to get him there.
But the NCAA made dunking illegal at that point. There are many tall white players. So can this be seen as a racially motivated rule, Kareem?
Not only
kind of
can
solid?
It be seen, it should be only seen as a racially motivated rule. If it was a tall white player dunking, it was a rule based upon race. If it was a white guy, if it was Dave Newmark, a friend of mine that I played with, who was 7'1" at Lincoln, that ends up at Columbia, same year, a year ahead of Louis, they wouldn't have made that rule, you know? But he was so dominant that they banned the dunk shot for a couple of years. It actually made Alcindor a better player because now he had to figure out different ways to make baskets, and he came up with that brilliant sky hook, probably the best shot that's ever played in basketball.
I'm surprised more people don't use it.
Not anymore, man. I coached AAU to this day in a high level, and you try to teach a kid how to take a hook shot, let alone a hook shot like Jabbar, they look at you like you're nuts.
How much did you know about the women's game when you began working on this series?
I knew about the women's game, but I didn't know about women, which I think is the story of my life anyway. But
sorry about that.
But when the women's game was first invented, it was 9 on a team. By the time, as late as the early 1970s, the women had to play 6 on a team. 3 were on one end of the court, 3 on the other. They could not pass half court because no one knew if women can have the stamina to play up and down,
to dribble back to back, down, back down and the forth.
So when Title, I have five or six different scenes on women. One is on Title IX, which was, by the way, Nixon was the president that signed Title IX. It had nothing to do with sports at the time, and Nixon had two daughters, so got to give him a little credit on that one. And I have a scene called Tomboys. I just love that phrase, tomboys. I mean, I want someone to attack me for using that phrase, you know, because all of the women in the scene, they were all called tomboys. You know, Cheryl Miller, Lynette Woodard, Ann Myers, Carol LeBlaze, Nancy Lieberman. No, Nancy Lieberman from Far Rockaway was a tomboy. She says it. And she played basketball day and night. Very poor. No father in the home. Her mother would have to take her to a psychiatrist all the time. What's the matter with her daughter? And walk around the house in the film and puncture all of her basketballs. Take the air out of them.
Wow.
Put a dress on, Nancy.
But I would assume a lot of the women who got involved in basketball came out of families where men played basketball.
Some. Cheryl Miller, obviously, but not Nancy Lieberman. Some. I don't think that there's a rule to that. Ann Myers, of course. Ann Myers ended up marrying Don Drysdale, which I love. I met her daughter, their daughter, at the Hall of Fame a couple of weeks ago. Lovely woman.
When did the women's game start to emerge and get real notice?
Well, this is relevant for tomorrow night coming up. Title IX really helped the women's game, and colleges began to excel. Tennessee was a great program. A little program outside of Philadelphia, a Jesuit school, Immaculata College.
But they were dominant even before Title IX.
No, they became dominant after Title IX, but they were not helped by Title IX because they couldn't afford the scholarships. Delta State in Mississippi, a dominant team. Old Dominion in Virginia. Title IX opened the doors, and the first great big school was Tennessee, coached by Pat Summitt. And that's a big scene tomorrow night, Pat Summitt versus Geno, the coach of Connecticut. That's a big scene tomorrow night. That rivalry was real, and it was nasty. And so this is a very tender scene also. So colleges are beginning to have great programs, Tennessee, Stanford, Connecticut, Duke, Georgia, Delta State, as I said. And then there's efforts to make professional leagues for women. But they fail. They fail. Until David Stern comes up with the idea of the WNBA, mm-hmm. meaning the men's teams are going to support the women's teams in the WNBA. And there's a business plan, and there's leadership, and there's cross-merchandising, and there's competition, but the W stands out. It's 21 years old now, and it's, thank God, it's still active, striving, great players. I love watching the women's game because I'm 68 years old, and the women play in an old-school way, fundamentally sound, but wow, are they good. I saw them in the Olympics in both London a few years ago and in Rio, and it's just a pleasure to watch. And Diana Taurasi, she's a big part of the film, and no BS. No BS. She's the Michael Jordan of the women's game.
Well, there isn't too much dunking in the women's game, so it actually has to be about strategy and teamwork and
that's
passing.
Right.
Pat Summitt, as you said, Coach Tennessee, a great female coach, but UConn was coached by Geno
Oriyama,
a man. Was it unusual or for a man to coach a women's team?
It's fairly usual. I think more so in the pros than it is in college. Geno is a fantastic coach. I mean, he recruits. But, boy, do they – I mean, what have they lost, two games in 6 years, 7 years? And he and Pat Summitt, they hated each other. Mm-hmm. That's what the scene is about. We could discuss – they respected each other. They respected each other. And that rivalry really propelled women's college basketball because television adopted it. Television's role in basketball cannot be underestimated. Mm-hmm. When you go back to Elvin Hayes and Lew Alcindor in 1968 in the Houston Astrodome, 55,000 seats, the number one and two teams in the country, and that battle between the two big men, and it's the first time that a college game is nationally syndicated, that becomes a big deal. Real basketball junkies of a certain age know where they were when they watched that game, what bar they were in on a black and white TV when they watched that.
Now, we talk about the importance of coaches. How important are coaches to the whole thing? After all, you put together a great team. Does it really need a great coach? And another question I have is, were the people who are great players who then went into coaching, did they turn out to be good coaches?
I think the coach is critically important to a championship mentality. The coach is the leader. The coach is the mentor, is the paternal or maternal figure. The coach is there to understand. There's so many great coaches in the film. And one of them says, you've got to know when you can pat him on the behind and when you can kick him on the behind. The coach is a psychologist. In the pros, you can win with talent, but you may not be able to win that championship. I mean, guys like Phil Jackson, you got to give him his due. I don't care if he had Michael Jordan or Scottie Pippen. I don't care if he had Kobe Bryant or Shaquille O'Neal. There are other coaches that would have had them that may not have won. That's the fact. A coach is critically important, but the role of the coach and the player relationship has changed forever, and that's sad. And it's the third scene in the film, because it's not chronological, is Sprewell choking his coach, P.J. Carlissimo, choking his coach in the mid-90s. That's what's happened. The coach is no longer the figure that gets the respect all the time. He's answered back. He's cursed at. He's walked away from, or she is. And that says so much about where we're at now. To me, it's sad. Do great players become great coaches? Usually not. It's a truth. Usually not. Russell was a coach, didn't win. Cousy was a coach, didn't win. Magic was a coach, didn't win. Riley was a sub, a great coach. Phil Jackson was a sub, a great coach. Larry Brown was a moderate player, a good player, but not on the level of the Magic, a great coach. The coach, patience is a virtue. And the great player, how come you can't do that? I could do it.
My guest is Dan Cloris. We are talking about basketball and his series on ESPN called Basketball, A Love Story. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5. We mentioned the Dream Team. Let's do a bit more talking about that. One of tomorrow's segments is on the Dream Team. But you have another segment about previous Olympic teams and how being Olympic athletes affected them.
Well, I have many segments on Olympics.
Well, for example, black players who felt that they were discriminated against too often were affected by Jim Crow.
The 1968 Olympics, which is very relevant today. In 68, 50 years ago, there were, of course, if you weren't questioning authority or the status quo, you know, then you were already saying, I'm going to work on Wall Street, you know? And lots was going on in America. Lots of strife, lots of questioning. So this, in 68, a bunch of black basketball players, spearheaded by a professor out west named Harry Edwards, decide that we're going to boycott the games. We want a fairer America for black people. Also, remember in 68, it's no longer we're going to take passive resistance as the way to go. There's the growth of the Black Panther movement and black nationalism. So there's that conflict. And for young black people, that's very, very real. Which way am I going to go? So many of them, Alcindor decides to boycott. Others decide to boycott. Some decide to go. Very, very, very big decision for young children, 18, 19, 20 years old. Charlie Scott, he goes. Spencer Haywood, raised in rural Mississippi, moved to Detroit when he's 14. An unbelievable player, he goes. JoJo White, great player at Kansas, Boston Celtics, he goes. Calvin Murphy wanted to go but didn't make the team. So they go in 68, and they're called Uncle Toms. They win the gold medal, but they're scared to go home. What's going to happen when Spencer Haywood goes home to Detroit? Because, of course, 68 is when the track and field guys raise their hands. In the film, it's actually remarkable. I cut to ABC TV, Howard Cosell and Chris Schenkel. Remember Chris Schenkel? Mm-hmm. They're on TV reporting on the wide world of sports, and Howard Cosell goes into his thing about race relations, and this means so much, and he goes into his whole thing. And Chris Schenkel just looks at him with that golden ABC sport jacket and says, well, thank you very much, Howard Cosell. He has no response at all to anything that Cosell is saying, you know? Which was, of course, the right way. It was provocative. So now, 50 years later, and we're going to have an Olympics in 2020, will there be another effort of black athletes saying, I'm not going? It's a fair question. It's a fair question to ask. The same way, I just wrote a piece that appeared in the undefeated African-American site, right, ESPN, on blacklisting. Everyone is talking about Colin Kaepernick, and clearly he's been blacklisted. Another thing, if you don't believe that, then go to work on Wall Street. But he's been blacklisted by the NFL. Now, my piece is about Kaepernick and the blacklisting that used to exist, and it's in the film, about NBA players. Black NBA players were completely blacklisted. Big part of Black Magic. Cleo Hill, a great player, was blacklisted because he didn't go along with what the coach and the white players wanted him to do with the St. Louis Hawks in 1960. Never played an NBA game again and led the team in scoring in the exhibition.
What did they want him to do?
Give him the ball.
Huh. I mean, he wanted to shoot more.
Yeah. Give him the ball. Give him the ball. It's in the undefeated, ran on Friday or Saturday. Give him the ball. It's always existed. Basketball, infinitely more open and progressive than the other major sports. Infinitely more. Well, you could see with football now, of course. Baseball's tried real hard, and I think the loss of the African-American child coming into playing baseball, I don't believe it has anything to do. It doesn't have anything to do with racism. It has to do with more and more people are beginning to play baseball all around the world.
Has it changed to some degree also because so many of the players these days are from other countries? The Knicks best star is definitely not
an American. Has what changed?
Has the racial dynamic on the teams changed?
I think it's about winning. You have any group of people, you're going to have issues. You know, and if it's between people of different color, well, okay, that doesn't mean it's race. You know?
I have very little time, and I wanted to get to the Air Jordans. Why the NBA banned Air Jordans?
Oh,
he was the NBA's biggest star.
Big scene tomorrow night on Mike. Two big scenes on Michael Jordan, and one is how he takes the deal. He takes the Nike deal as opposed to Adidas. And they come up with this marvelous, brilliant marketing ploy to create this sneaker called Air Jordan. Buy this sneaker, you'll jump higher, you'll be Michael. All the great Madison Avenue subliminal messages. And the NBA got nervous about it because they weren't getting a take on it. It's going to earn millions and millions and millions of dollars. So they say, no player could use this. It doesn't conform to the two colors that a sneaker needs to be. So, of course, they work it out. But to this day, and Rick Welts, who was head of marketing at the NBA at the time, a great guy, now he's the president of Golden State Warriors, says that might have been the greatest advertising campaign of all time, Air Jordan. That was the campaign that Spike Lee was in. I don't know if he didn't create it, but or maybe he did. I forget.
I think he did.
Yeah.
He directed it.
Directed it. I don't know if he created it.
I've heard
He didn't create the Air Jordan name. I know that.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the fans so far? Because this has been running for a while. I've heard that some felt that you went too easy on Bobby Knight.
You can feel that way. I don't think I went too easy on Bobby Knight. I mean, look, here's my deal on Bobby Knight. I think Bobby Knight was a brilliant, brilliant coach and teacher. He created the motion offense. His defense was superb. Does he have emotional issues? Well, of course he does. Was he too rough? Well, of course he was. But my conclusion, I let his player say it. His African-American player say it in the film. We didn't know it then, but what we understood, he didn't want to be our friend. He wanted to be our coach and teacher, and he did everything to make us better human beings. He was tough. Did I go too easy on him? I show what a maniac he is. Mm-hmm. So I disagree with that, but I could see how someone might want to say that, but I completely disagree with it.
Now, you had 20 hours.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there were things that you couldn't get in that you wanted to get in.
Yeah.
Would you wish that you'd had 24 hours?
Yes. I wish I would have had more.
You have a book. You've co-authored
the
book.
The book came out, Jackie McMullen's An Oral History Basketball Love Story, that based upon the interviews that we did. It's a wonderful book by Crown. A Christmas gift. I got to give a plug, you know? And she worked so hard. And I wish I would have had more time. I got my 13th and 14th hour on a bet. I'm in the car with John Skipper, the chairman of ESPN, and his guy Connor Schell, leaving Bob Iger's home in California, the head of Disney, 3 or 4 years ago. Skipper's well-read, from North Carolina, a Southerner, a big UNC fan. We're in the car and he drawls, you know, my favorite player was from NC State, not North Carolina. I said, John, if I guess your favorite player, you give me 2 more hours? Mm-hmm. No hints. He goes, yeah. I said, Eddie Biedenbach. That's how I got 14 hours.
How did you know that it was Eddie Biedenbach?
That was a good guess.
And if you would guess wrong?
Nothing. No lose, man.
Now, this is being shown on ESPN. After that's over, will it be accessible online?
Yeah, they're showing it now. You could go into their apps and get seen story by story. You don't have to watch it in a linear way. You could go in and watch this story. You could go in and watch Pat versus Gino anytime. That's tomorrow night. Rick Pitino is tomorrow night. But you could watch it at any time.
The music isn't always basketball related.
No.
But what about the people who narrated these episodes? People like Michael Che, Julianna Moore, Ashley Judd. Are they basketball fans?
Yeah, and that was so much fun. I wanted a different narrator from each night. I wanted to skew a little younger, you know? And they're basketball fans, and some I knew and some I didn't. Julianna Moore, her son, plays basketball at Davidson. Her husband's a big basketball guy, so is she. Michael Che loves basketball. David Diggs, they all love basketball. Anson Elgar, I don't know if I was a man or a woman, but I heard he likes basketball, right? Robin Quivers loves basketball. Chris Cuomo, Ahmad Rashad. So Ashley Judge, she's a big basketball fan. So they were just great, and they were serious. They came in the studio, no, like you guys, no messing around. They want to get it right, you know? They want to get it right. There was hardly any directing. Leave it to them. They were pros, man.
You know? So what do you think about the current state of basketball? America no longer dominates.
Yeah, that's fine. I think that's great. I think it's my theory is basketball is a global common denominator. You go any place in the world, there's only a few things that you can open up a conversation with: sex, God, food, music, basketball. You can't go to Nebraska and start talking about soccer, but you can go to Cuba and talk about any of these things. You can go to Nigeria and talk about any of these things. Lithuania, you know, Cambodia, you can talk about basketball. Drugs, another one, I think.
ESPN is showing Basketball, A Love Story on Tuesday nights between 8 and midnight. And my great thanks to the series creator and Peabody Award winning director, Dan Cloris, for being on our show today.
Thank you so much, Leonard. Thank you, guys. Pleasure. Pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Dan Cloris, to Fran Higgins, who produced this segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who is at the audio controls today.
Leonard Lopate and Large comes to you
on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.